hypnotic state all have something in common. Sleep, dream, and trance all release the activity of the subconscious, the undermind. They tend to employ primary process thinking, while waking mentation is secondary process, rational. But now, look at the EEG records of the four states. Now it's the D state, the trance, and the waking state that have a lot in common, while the S state, sleep, is utterly different. And you can't get straight from trance into true D state dreaming. The S state must intervene. Normally, you only enter D state 4 or 5 times a night, every hour or two, and only for a quarter of an hour at a time. The rest of the time, you're in one stage or another of normal sleep. And there, you'll dream, but usually not vividly. Mentation in S-sleep is like an engine idling, a kind of steady muttering of images and thoughts. What we're after are the vivid, emotional-laden, memorable dreams of the D-state. Our hypnosis plus the augmenter will ensure that we get them, get across the neurophysiological and temporal gulf of sleep right into dreaming. So we'll need you on the couch here. My field was pioneered by Dement, Azarinsky, Berger, Oswald, Hartman, and the rest, but the couch we get straight from Papa Freud. But we use it to sleep on, which he objected to. Now, what I want, just for a starter, is for you to sit down here on the foot of the couch. Yes, that's it. You'll be there a while, so make yourself comfortable. You said you'd tried auto-hypnosis, didn't you? All right, just go ahead and use the techniques you used for that. How about deep breathing? Count 10 while you inhale. Hold for 5. Yes, right, excellent. Would you mind looking up at the ceiling, straight up over your head? Okay, right. As Orr obediently tipped his head back, Haber, close beside him, reached out quickly and quietly and put his left hand behind the man's head, pressing firmly with the thumb and one finger behind and below each ear. At the same time, with right thumb and finger, he pressed hard on the bared throat just below the soft blonde beard, where the vagus nerve and carotid artery run. He was aware of the fine, sallow skin under his fingers. He felt the first startled movement of protest, then saw the clear eyes closing. He felt a thrill of enjoyment of his own skill, his instant dominance over the patient, even as he was muttering softly and rapidly, "You're going to sleep now. Close your eyes. Sleep. Relax. Let your mind go blank. You're going to sleep. You're relaxed. You're going limp. Relax. Let go." And Orr fell backward on the couch like a man shot dead, his right hand dropping lax from his side. Haber knelt by him at once, keeping his right hand lightly on the pressure spots and never stopping the quiet, quick flow of suggestion. "You're in a trance now, not asleep but deeply in hypnotic trance, and you will not come out of it and awaken until I tell you to do so. You're in trance now and going deeper all the time into trance, but you can still hear my voice and follow my instructions. After this, whenever I simply touch you on the throat as I'm doing now, you'll enter the hypnotic trance at once." He repeated the instructions and went on. "Now, when I tell you to open your eyes, you'll do so and see a crystal ball floating in front of you. I want you to fix your attention on it closely, and as you do so, you will continue to go deeper into trance. Now open your eyes. Yes. Good. And tell me when you see the crystal ball." The light eyes, now with a curious inward gaze, looked past Haber at nothing. "Now," the hypnotized man said very softly. "Good. Keep gazing at it and breathing regularly. Soon you'll be in very deep trance." Haber glanced up at the clock. The whole business had only taken a couple of minutes. Good. He didn't like to waste time on means. Getting to the desired end was the thing. While Orr lay staring at his imaginary crystal ball, Haber got up and began fitting him with the modified tran cap, constantly removing and replacing it to readjust the tiny electrodes and position them on the scalp under the thick, light brown hair. He spoke often and softly, repeating suggestions and occasionally asking bland questions so that Orr would not drift off into sleep yet and would stay in rapport. As soon as the cap was in place, he switched on the EEG, and for a while he watched it to see what this brain looked like. 8 of the cap's electrodes went to the EEG. Inside the machine, 8 pens scored a permanent record of the brain's electrical activity. On the screen, which Haber watched, the impulses were reproduced directly, jittering white scribbles on dark gray. He could isolate and enlarge one or superimpose one on another at will. It was a scene he never tired of, the all-night movie. The show on Channel 1. There were none of the sigmoid jags he looked for, the concomitant of certain schizoid personality types. There was nothing unusual about the total pattern, except its diversity. A simple brain produces a relatively simple jig-jog set of patterns and is content to repeat them. This was not a simple brain. Its motions were subtle and complex, and the repetitions neither frequent nor unvaried. The computer of the augmenter would analyze them, but until he saw the analysis, Haber could isolate no singular factor except the complexity itself. On commanding the patient to cease seeing the crystal ball and close his eyes, he obtained almost at once a strong, clear alpha trace at 12 cycles. He played about a little more with the brain, getting records for the computer and testing hypnotic depth, and then said, "Now, John..." Now, what the hell was the subject's name? "George, now you're going to go to sleep in a minute. You're going to go sound asleep and dream. But you won't go to sleep until I say the word Antwerp. When I say that, you'll go to sleep. And sleep until I say your name 3 times. Now, when you sleep, you're going to have a dream. A good dream. One clear, pleasant dream. Not a bad dream at all. A pleasant one, but very clear and vivid. You'll be sure to remember it when you wake up. It will be about..." He hesitated a moment. He hadn't planned anything, relying on inspiration. "About a horse. A big bay horse galloping in a field, running around. Maybe you'll ride the horse, or catch him, or maybe just watch him. But the dream will be about a horse. A vivid..." What was the word the patient had used? "Effective dream about a horse. After that, you won't dream anything else. And when I speak your name 3 times, you'll wake up feeling calm and rested. Now I am going to send you to sleep by saying Antwerp." Obedient, the little dancing lines on the screen began to change. They grew stronger and slower. Soon the sleep spindles of stage 2 sleep began to appear, and the hint of the long, deep delta rhythm of stage 4. And as the brain's rhythms changed, so did the heavy matter inhabited by the dancing energy. The hands were lax on the slow-breathing chest. The face was aloof and still. The augmenter had got a full record of the waking brain's patterns. Now it was recording and analyzing the S-sleep patterns. Soon it would be picking up the beginning of the patient's D-sleep patterns, and would be able, even within this first dream, to feed them back to the sleeping brain, amplifying its own emissions. Indeed, it might be doing so now. Haber had expected a wait, but the hypnotic suggestion, plus the patient's long semi-deprivation of dreams, were putting him into the D state at once. No sooner had he reached stage 2 than he began the reascent. The slowly swaying lines on the screen jittered once here and there, jigged again, began to quicken and dance, taking on a rapid, unsynchronized rhythm. Now the pons was active, and the trace from the hippocampus showed a 5-second cycle, the theta rhythm, which had not showed up clearly in this subject. The fingers moved a little, the eyes under closed lids moved, watching, the lips parted for a deep breath. The sleeper dreamed. It was 5:06. At 5:11, Haber pressed the black off button on the augmenter. At 5:12, noticing the deep jags and spindles of S-sleep reappearing, he leaned over the patient and said his name clearly thrice. Orr sighed, moved his arm in a wide, loose gesture, opened his eyes, and wakened. Haber detached the electrodes from his scalp in a few deft motions. "Feel okay?" he asked, genial and assured. "Fine." "And you dreamed, that much I can tell you. Can you tell me the dream?" "A horse," Orr said huskily, still bewildered by sleep. He sat up. "It was about a horse. That one." And he waved his hand toward the picture window-sized mural that decorated Haber's office, a photograph of the great racing stallion Tammany Hall at play in a grassy paddock. "What did you dream about it?" Haber said, pleased. He had not been sure hypnosuggestion would work on dream content in a first hypnosis. I was walking in this field, and it was off in the distance for a while. Then it came galloping at me, and after a while I realized it was going to run me down. I wasn't scared at all, though. I figured perhaps I could catch its bridle, or swing up and ride it. I knew that actually it couldn't hurt me because it was the horse in your picture, not a real one. It was all a sort of game. Dr. Haber, does anything about that picture strike you as unusual? Well, some people find it overdramatic for a shrink's office, a bit overwhelming. A life-size sex symbol right opposite the couch, he laughed. Was it there an hour ago? I mean, wasn't that a view of Mount Hood when I came in, before I dreamed about the horse? Oh, Christ, it had been Mount Hood. The man was right. It had not been Mount Hood. It could not have been Mount Hood. It was a horse. It was a horse. It had been a mountain. A horse. It was a horse. It was... He was staring at George Orr, staring blankly at him. Several seconds must have passed since Orr's question. He must not be caught out. He must inspire confidence. He knew the answers. George, do you remember the picture there as being a photograph of Mount Hood? Yes, Orr said in his rather sad but unshaken way. I do. It was. Snow on it. Haber nodded judicially, pondering. The awful chill at the pit of his chest had passed. You don't? The man's eyes, so elusive in color, yet clear and direct in gaze, they were the eyes of a psychotic. No, I'm afraid I don't. It's Tammany Hall, the triple winner back in 89. I miss the races. It's a shame the way the lower species get crowded out by our food problems. Of course, a horse is the perfect anachronism, but I like the picture. It has vigor, strength, total self-realization in animal terms. It's a sort of ideal of what a psychiatrist strives to achieve in human psychological terms, a symbol. It's the source of my suggestion of your dream content. Of course, I happened to be looking at it. Haber glanced sidelong at the mural. Of course it was the horse. But listen, if you want a third opinion, we'll ask Miss Crouch. She's worked here 2 years. She'll say it always was a horse, Orr said calmly but ruefully. It always was, since my dream, always has been. I thought that maybe, since you suggested the dream to me, you might have the double memory, like me. But I guess you don't. But his eyes, no longer downcast, looked again at Haber with that clarity, that forbearance, that quiet and despairing plea for help. The man was sick. He must be cured. I'd like you to come again, George, and tomorrow, if possible. Well, I work. Get off an hour early and come here at 4. You're under VTT. Tell your boss and don't feel any false shame about it. At one time or another, 82% of the population gets VTT, not to mention the 31% that gets OTT. So be here at 4 and we'll get to work. We're going to get somewhere with this, you know. Now here's a prescription for metrobamate. It will keep your dreams low-keyed without suppressing the D-state entirely. You can refill it at the auto drug every 3 days. If you have a dream or any other experience that frightens you, call me, day or night. But I doubt you will, using that. And if you're willing to work hard at this one with me, you won't be needing any drugs much longer. You'll have this whole problem with your dreams licked and be out in the clear, right? Orr took the IBM prescription card.
It would be a relief, he said.
He smiled, a tentative, unhappy, yet not humorless smile.
Another thing about the horse, he said.
Haber, a head taller, stared down at him.
It looks like you, Orr said.
Haber looked up quickly at the mural. It did. Big, healthy, hairy, reddish-brown, bearing down at full gallop.
Perhaps the horse in your dream resembled me, he asked, shrewdly genial.
Yes, it did, the patient said.
When he was gone, Haber sat down and looked up uneasily at the mural photograph of Tammany Hall. It really was too big for the office. God damn, but he wished he could afford an office with a window with a view.
Chapter 3 Those whom heaven helps, we call the sons of heaven. They do not learn this by learning. They do not work it by working. They do not reason it by using reason. To let understanding stop at what cannot be understood is a high attainment. Those who cannot do it will be destroyed on the lathe of heaven.
Chuang Tse, 23.
George Orr left work at 3:30 and walked to the subway station. He had no car. By saving, he might have afforded a VW steamer and the mileage tax on it, but what for? Downtown was closed to automobiles, and he lived downtown. He had learned to drive back in the 80s, but had never owned a car. He rode the Vancouver subway back into Portland. The trains were already jam-packed. He stood out of reach of strap or stanchion, supported solely by the equalizing pressures of bodies on all sides, occasionally lifted right off his feet and floating as the force of crowding, C, exceeded the force of gravity, G. A man next to him holding a newspaper had never been able to lower his arms, but stood with his face muffled in the sports section. The headline, Big A1 Strike Near Afghan Border, and the subhead, Threat of Afghan Intervention, stared Orr eye to eye for six stops. The newspaper holder fought his way off and was replaced by a couple of tomatoes on a green plastic plate, beneath which was an old lady in a green plastic coat, who stood on Orr's left foot for three more stops. He struggled off at the East Broadway stop and shoved along for four blocks through the ever-thickening off-work crowd at Willamette East Tower, a great showy shoddy shaft of concrete and glass, competing with vegetable obstinacy for light and air with the jungle of similar buildings all around it. Very little light and air got down to street level. What there was warm and full of fine rain. Rain was an old Portland tradition, but the warmth, 70 degrees Fahrenheit on the 2nd of March, was modern, a result of air pollution. Urban and industrial effluvia had not been controlled soon enough to reverse the cumulative trends already at work in the mid-20th century. It would take several centuries for the CO2 to clear out of the air, if it ever did. New York was going to be one of the larger casualties of the greenhouse effect, as the polar ice kept melting and the sea kept rising. Indeed, all Boswash was imperiled. There were some compensations. San Francisco Bay was already on the rise and would end up covering all the hundreds of square miles of landfill and garbage dumped into it since 1848. As for Portland, with 80 miles and the coast range between it and the sea, it was not threatened by rising water, only by falling water. It had always rained in western Oregon, but now it rained ceaselessly, steadily, tepidly. It was like living in a downpour of warm soup forever. The new cities, Umatilla, John Day, French Glen, were east of the Cascades, in what had been desert 30 years before. It was fiercely hot there still in summer, but it rained only 45 inches a year, compared with Portland's 114 inches. Intensive farming was possible. The desert blossomed.
French Glen now had a population of 7 million. Portland, with only 3 million and no growth potential, had been left far behind in the march of progress. That was nothing new for Portland. And what difference did it make? Undernourishment, overcrowding, and pervading foulness of the environment were the norm. There was more scurvy, typhus, and hepatitis in the old cities, more gang violence, crime, and murder in the new cities. The rats ran one, and the mafia ran the other. George Orr stayed in Portland because he had always lived there, and because he had no reason to believe that life anywhere else would be better or different. Miss Crouch, smiling uninterestedly, showed him right in. Orr had thought that psychiatrists' offices, like rabbit holes, always had a front and a back door. This one didn't, but he doubted that patients were likely to run into one another coming and going here. Up at the medical school, they had said that Dr. Haber had only a small psychiatric practice, being essentially a research man. That had given him the notion of someone successful and exclusive, and the doctor's jovial, masterful manner had confirmed it. But today, less nervous, he saw more. The office didn't have the platinum and leather assurance of financial success, nor the rag-and-bottle assurance of scientific disinterest. The chairs and couch were vinyl. The desk was metal plastic coated with a wood finish. Nothing whatever was genuine. Dr. Haber, white-toothed, bay-maned, huge, boomed out, "Good afternoon." That geniality was not faked, but it was exaggerated. There was a warmth to the man, an outgoingness, which was real, but it had got plastic-coated with professional mannerisms, distorted by the doctor's unspontaneous use of himself. Orr felt in him a wish to be liked and a desire to be helpful. The doctor was not, he thought, really sure that anyone else existed, and wanted to prove they did by helping them. He boomed, "Good afternoon," so loud, because he was never sure he would get an answer. Orr wanted to say something friendly, but nothing personal seemed suitable. He said, "It looks as if Afghanistan might get into the war." That's been in the cards since last August." He should have known that the doctor would be better informed on world affairs than himself. He was generally semi-informed and 3 weeks out of date. "I don't think that'll shake the Allies," Haber went on, "unless it pulls Pakistan in on the Iranian side. Then India may have to send in more than token support for the Israegypts." That was teleglot for the New Arab Republic-Israel Alliance. "I think Gupta's speech in Delhi shows that he's preparing for that eventuality." "It keeps spreading," Orr said, feeling inadequate and despondent. "The war, I mean."
"Does it worry you?"
"Doesn't it worry you?"
"Irrelevant," said the doctor, smiling his broad, hairy bear smile, like a big bear god. But he was still wary since yesterday. "Yes, it worries me."
But Haber had not earned that answer. The questioner cannot withdraw himself from the question, assuming objectivity, as if the answers were an object. Orr did not speak these thoughts, however. He was in a doctor's hands, and surely the doctor knew what he was doing. Orr had a tendency to assume that people knew what they were doing, perhaps because he generally assumed that he did not.
"Sleep well?"
Haber inquired, sitting down under the left rear hoof of Tammany Hall.
"Fine, thanks."
"How do you feel about another go in the Palace of Dreams?"
He was watching keenly.
"Sure, that's what I'm here for, I guess."
He saw Haber rise and come around the desk. He saw the large hand come out toward his neck, and then nothing happened.
"George?"
His name. Who called? No voice he knew. Dry land, dry air. The crash of a strange voice in his ear. Daylight, and no direction, no way back. He woke. The half-familiar room, the half-familiar big man in his voluminous russet Gernreich, with his red-brown beard and white smile and opaque dark eyes.
"It looked like a short dream, but a lively one on the EEG," said the deep voice. "Let's have it. Sooner the recall, the completer it is."
Orr sat up, feeling rather dizzy. He was on the couch,
How had he got there?
Let's see, it wasn't much. The horse again. Did you tell me to dream of the horse again when I was hypnotized?
Haber shook his head, meaning neither yes nor no, and listened.
Well, this was a stable. This room. Straw and a manger and a pitchfork in the corner and so on. The horse was in it. He...
Haber's expectant silence permitted no evasion.
He did this tremendous pile of shit. Brown, steaming horse shit. It looked kind of like Mount Hood, with that little hump on the north side and everything. It was all over the rug and sort of encroaching on me, so I said, "It's only the picture of the mountain." Then I guess I started to wake up.
Orr raised his face, looking past Dr. Haber at the mural behind him, the wall-sized photograph of Mount Hood. It was a serene picture in rather muted, arty tones. The sky gray, the mountain a soft brown or reddish brown, with speckles of white near the summit, and the foreground all dusky, formless treetops. The doctor was not looking at the mural. He was watching Orr with those keen, opaque eyes. He laughed when Orr was done, not long or loudly, but perhaps a little excitedly.
"We're getting somewhere, George."
"Where?"
Orr felt rumpled and foolish, sitting on the couch, still giddy from sleep, having lain asleep there, probably with his mouth open and snoring, helpless, while Haber watched the secret jigs and prancing of his brain and told him what to dream. He felt exposed, used, and to what end? Evidently the doctor had no memory at all of the horse mural, nor of the conversation they had had concerning it. He was altogether in this new present, and all his memories led to it. So he could not do any good at all. But he was striding up and down the office now, talking even louder than usual.
"Well, A, you can and do dream to order. You follow the hypno-suggestions. B, you respond splendidly to the augmenter. Therefore, we can work together, fast and efficiently, without narcosis. I'd rather work without drugs. What the brain does by itself is infinitely more fascinating and complex than any response it can make to chemical stimulation. That's why I developed the augmenter, to provide the brain a means of self-stimulation, the creative and therapeutic resources of the brain, whether waking or sleeping or dreaming, are practically infinite. If we can just find the keys to all the locks, the power of dreaming alone is quite undreamt of."
He laughed his big laugh. He made that little joke many times. Orr smiled uncomfortably. It struck a bit close to home.
"I am sure now that your therapy lies in this direction, to use your dreams, not to evade and avoid them, to face your fear and with my help see it through. You're afraid of your own mind, George. That's a fear no man can live with, but you don't have to. You haven't seen the help your own mind can give you, the ways you can use it, employ it creatively. All you need to do is not to hide from your own mental powers, not to suppress them, but to release them. This we can do together. Now, doesn't that strike you as right, as the right thing to do?"
"I don't know," Orr said.
When Haber spoke of using, employing his mental powers, he had thought for a moment that the doctor must mean his power of changing reality by dreaming. But surely, if he'd meant that, he would have said it clearly. Knowing that Orr desperately needed confirmation, he would not causelessly withhold it if he could give it. Orr's heart sank. The use of narcotics and pep pills had left him emotionally off balance. He knew that, and therefore kept trying to combat and control his feelings. But this disappointment was beyond his control. He had, he now realized, allowed himself a little hope. He had been sure, yesterday, that the doctor was aware of the change from mountain to horse. It hadn't surprised or alarmed him that Haber tried to hide his awareness. In the first shock, no doubt he had been unable to admit it even to himself, to encompass it.
It had taken Orr himself a long time to bring himself to face the fact that he was doing something impossible. Yet he had let himself hope that Haber, knowing the dream and being there as it was dreamed at the center, might see the change, might remember and confirm. No good. No way out. Orr was where he had been for months, alone, knowing he was insane, and knowing he was not insane, simultaneously and intensely. It was enough to drive him insane. "Would it be possible," he said diffidently, "for you to give me a post-hypnotic suggestion not to dream effectively? Since you can suggest that I do, that way I could get off drugs at least for a while." Haber settled down behind his desk, hunched like a bear. "I very much doubt it would work, even through one night," he said quite simply, and then, suddenly booming again, "Isn't that the same fruitless direction you've been trying to go, George? Drugs or hypnosis, it's still suppression. You can't run away from your own mind. You see that, but you're not quite willing yet to face it. That's all right. Look at it this way. Twice now you've dreamed, right here, on that couch. Was it so bad? Did it do any harm?" Orr shook his head, too low-spirited to answer. Haber went on talking, and Orr tried to give him his attention. He was talking now about daydreams, about their relationship to the hour-and-a-half dreaming cycles of the night, about their uses and value. He asked Orr if any particular type of daydream was congenial to him. "For example," he said, "I frequently daydream heroics. I am the hero. I'm saving a girl, or a fellow astronaut, or a besieged city, or a whole damn planet. Messiah dreams, do-gooder dreams. Haber saves the world. They're a hell of a lot of fun, so long as I keep them where they belong. We all need that ego boost we get from daydreams. But when we start relying on it, then our reality parameters are getting a bit shaky. Then there's the South Sea Island-type daydreams. A lot of middle-aged executives go in for them. And the noble suffering martyr type. And the various romantic fantasies of adolescence. And the sadomasochist dream, and so on. Most people recognize most types. We've almost all been in the arena facing the lions at least once, or thrown a bomb and destroyed our enemies, or rescued the pneumatic virgin from the sinking ship, or written Beethoven's Tenth Symphony for him. Which style do you favor?"
"Oh, escape," Orr said. He really had to pull himself together and answer this man, who was trying to help him. "Getting away, getting out from under."
"Out from under the job, the daily grind?" Haber seemed to refuse to believe that he was contented with his job. No doubt Haber had a lot of ambition and found it hard to believe that a man could be without it.
"Well, it's more the city, the crowding, I mean. Too many people everywhere, the headlines, everything."
"South Seas?" Haber inquired with his bear's grin.
"No, here. I'm not very imaginative. I daydream about having a cabin somewhere outside the cities, maybe over in the coast range where there's still some of the old forests."
"Ever considered actually buying one?"
"Recreation land is about $38,000 an acre in the cheapest areas, down in the South Oregon wilderness. Goes up to about $400,000 for a lot with a beach view."
Haber whistled. "I see you have considered, and so returned to your daydreams. Thank God they're free, eh? Well, are you game for another go? We've got nearly half an hour left."
"Could you..."
"What, George?"
"Let me keep recall."
Haber began one of his elaborate refusals. "Now, as you know, what is experienced during hypnosis, including all directions given, is normally blocked to waking recall by a mechanism similar to that which blocks recall of 99% of our dreams. To lower that block would be to give you too many conflicting directions concerning what is a fairly delicate matter, the content of a dream you haven't yet dreamed. That, the dream, I can direct you to recall.
but I don't want your recall of my suggestions all mixed up with your recall of the dream you actually dream. I want to keep them separate, to get a clear report of what you did dream, not what you think you ought to have dreamed, right? You can trust me, you know. I'm in this game to help you. I won't ask too much of you. I'll push you, but not too hard or too fast. I won't give you any nightmares. Believe me, I want to see this through and understand it as much as you do. You're an intelligent and cooperative subject, and a courageous man to have borne so much anxiety alone so long. We'll see this through, George. Believe me.
Orr did not entirely believe him, but he was as uncontradictable as a preacher, and besides, he wished he could believe him. He said nothing, but lay back on the couch and submitted to the touch of the great hand on his throat.
Okay, there you are. What did you dream, George? Let's have it, hot off the griddle.
He felt sick and stupid.
Something about the South Seas. Coconuts. Can't remember.
He rubbed his head, scratched under his short beard, took a deep breath. He longed for a drink of cold water.
Then I dreamed that you were walking with John Kennedy, the president, down Alder Street, I think it was. I was sort of coming along behind. I think I was carrying something for one of you. Kennedy had his umbrella up. I saw him in profile, like the old 50-cent pieces, and you said,
"You won't be needing that anymore, Mr. President,"
and took it out of his hand. He seemed to get annoyed over it. He said something I couldn't understand. But it had stopped raining, the sun came out, and so he said,
"I suppose you're right now."
"It has stopped raining."
"How do you know?" Orr sighed.
"You'll see it when you go out. Is that all for this afternoon?"
"I'm ready for more. Bills on the government, you know."
"I'm very tired."
"Well, all right then. That wraps it up for today. Listen, what if we had our sessions at night? Let you go to sleep normally. Use the hypnosis only to suggest dream content. It'd leave your working days clear, and my working day is night half the time. One thing sleep researchers seldom do is sleep. It would speed us up tremendously, and save your having to use any dream-suppressant drugs. You want to give it a try? How about Friday night?"
"I've got a date," Orr said, and was startled at his lie.
"Saturday, then."
"All right."
He left, carrying his damp raincoat over his arm. There was no need to wear it. The Kennedy dream had been a strong effective. He was sure of them now. When he had them, no matter how bland their content, he woke from them recalling them with intense clarity and feeling broken and abraded, as one might after making an enormous physical effort to resist an overwhelming, battering force. On his own, he had not had one oftener than once a month or once in 6 weeks. It had been the fear of having one that had obsessed him. Now, with the augmenter keeping him in dreaming sleep and the hypnotic suggestions insisting that he dream effectively, he had had 3 effective dreams out of 4 in 2 days, or, discounting the coconut dream, which had been rather what Haber called a mere muttering of images, 3 out of 3. He was exhausted. It was not raining. When he came out of the portals of Willamette East Tower, the March sky was high and clear above the street canyons. The wind had come round to blow from the east, the dry desert wind that from time to time enlivened the wet, hot, sad, gray weather of the valley of the Willamette. The clearer air roused his spirits a bit. He straightened his shoulders and set off, trying to ignore a faint dizziness that was probably the combined result of fatigue, anxiety, 2 brief naps at an unusual time of day, and a 62-story descent by elevator. Had the doctor told him to dream that it had stopped raining? Or had the suggestion been to dream about Kennedy, who had, now that he thought about it again, had Abraham Lincoln's beard? Or about Haber himself? He had no way of telling. The effective part of the dream had been the stopping of the rain, the change of weather.
But that proved nothing. Often it was not the apparently striking or salient element of a dream that was the effective one. He suspected that Kennedy, for reasons known only to